Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Election Day 2021 is a week out, and county boards of election are still working to recruit poll workers, especially in Ohio's big cities. The pandemic may be contributing to hesitancy for some. In a recent interview with NBC4, Secretary of State Frank LaRose emphasized that Ohio polling locations are safe.
If you feel safe going to the grocery store, you should feel safe working at the polls or going to vote at the polls on Election Day.
Aaron Ackerman is the executive director of the Ohio Association of Election Officials. Aaron, welcome back.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be here and great to see you face to face today.
You too. Nice to be in the studio. A couple of weeks ago, Secretary of State LaRose said Ohio was short thousands of poll workers. What does that translate to? What does that mean?
Well, the good news is, as of today, we have made a pretty dramatic recovery in that. In fact, I saw Secretary LaRose issued some statements on Friday saying that we had really kind of turned a corner. We kind of redoubled our efforts and got the word out that we still needed a lot of poll workers. So not that we're done recruiting. We're never done recruiting. We always want to get as many people as possible. But I think we're in a better place right now, which is good.
Can people still sign up?
They can. Yeah, I spoke to the folks at the Franklin County Board of Elections, since we're here in Central Ohio, and they said they'll take people really until Thursday, mm-hmm. and they plan to train probably all the way up until Monday. And so we'll keep signing people up. I know they're still short a few here in Franklin County in particular. As you mentioned, the urban counties tend to be the ones that really are digging until the last minute. But we'll keep recruiting. We'll keep training all the way up to Election Day.
And what is training like?
It's about a 3-hour process. It's actually really fun. I've been a poll worker for years, and they take you in kind of an in-depth, behind-the-scenes tour of what it means to operate a polling location. So they train you on how to check people in, how to operate the machines. In Franklin County, we tend to get people specialized. So if they may assign you to provisional voting or paper-based voting, they may assign you to an actual voting machine to work on. They may assign you to check people in. But they kind of run you through the whole process over about 3 hours. Then they do some follow-up this weekend. We have a big follow-up. Get you a little extra pay if you want to come in and do some additional training. But it's a fun process.
I can see why they do specialization, but that's if they have the luxury of doing specialization, right?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, there's a few different tasks that we have to accomplish at the polls. Everything from just kind of running the location. We have voting location managers that run, and those tend to be our more seasoned poll workers. But as I mentioned, you know, whether it's dealing with the equipment itself, whether it's checking voters in, whether it's handling people that need to vote provisionally, because that's a little separate process. We do have some specialization out there, and it's worked out well for Franklin County. They do a nice job.
What happened? I mean, what did last year teach you about what's coming up this year, at least? There haven't been any beneath-the-surface changes, right, in how to vote?
Correct. Yeah, it's largely going to be the same process for voters this year. We still have a lot of COVID protocols in place, so you'll still see masks out at the polling location. You'll see we have gallons and gallons of hand sanitizer left over from last year, yeah. So you can wash your hands after you vote or before you vote. But the process in and of itself is going to largely be the same. Probably won't see the lines that you saw last year. Mm-hmm. Just turnout's not going to be quite the same this year, but process is going to be largely the same.
Are the expectations about turnout this year?
Lower, unfortunately.
As always.
Yeah, as always. Yeah, I did a little research, and that's one of the things I really want to emphasize today, Ann, is this is an important election, and there's really no reason why turnout should be lower. In fact, that's something we constantly worry about. In the past, it's been as low as like 27% in an odd year general mm-hmm. election, and as high, and I say that, you know, not really with a lot of enthusiasm, as high as 47%. So our best turnout election in an election like this is still less than 50% of the registered voters. So get out and vote. It's an important thing.
But it's probably too late to request an absentee ballot?
You can request an absentee ballot actually until Saturday at noon. Under our
But how will
law.
It arrive in time?
Well, we're working on that in the legislature. We're actually trying to get that changed. You can request it, but, you know, we would suggest really today is the day. If you want to vote by mail, absentee, really you should think about getting that request in today. You can certainly show up at the Board of Elections. We vote people early at the Board of Elections. Mm-hmm. We'll do that all the way up until Monday. But if you're going to request it by mail, even though the law says you can wait till Saturday, don't procrastinate. Today's your day to do it.
And voting by mail, first you have to request the ballot, right?
Correct.
And yep. Then you fill the ballot out, and then you mail it. And then if it doesn't get there on time?
So in Ohio, as long as the ballot is postmarked the day before the election, so as long as you get it back in the mail by next Monday and we receive it within 10 days after the election, we will count it. Again, you're putting a little faith in the post office at that point. You can always return it to the Board of Elections. You can drop it off by hand. We have ballot boxes out there, drop boxes out there, so you can drop it off through that mechanism as well. But yeah, you're definitely putting a little bit of faith in the post office as you get closer and closer to the election.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're going to be talking about Issue 7 on the Franklin County or the Columbus City ballot, and we're going to be talking about the special election for the 15th Congressional District race today as well. Right now, I'm talking with Aaron Ackerman. He's Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Election Officials. When we talk about being a poll worker and the safety of being a poll worker, there's the germ issue, but there's also a lot of people who don't feel safe because of the polarization, because of the divisiveness out there right now. What kinds of processes are in place to make sure people aren't confronted with that kind of thing?
That's a great question. And particularly in 2020, we learned a lot about that. So we actually do de-escalation training now with our poll workers, which is more or less teaching them techniques to avoid confrontations and how to kind of walk people off the ledge if you get in those heated situations. So we actually factor that into our training at this point, and we work on that. You know, the thing that poll workers and voters should really keep in mind is, you know, polling locations are safe. They are designated safe spaces, right? So you're not allowed to carry weapons within them, within 100 feet of them. The police, we have memorandums of understanding with our local law enforcement so that they can be on scene in a moment's notice if things happen. That rarely
right,
does.
I want to
emphasize that, but that option exists.
I was surprised in the early voting how many people were confronted with people promoting one issue over another, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that fine line, right, Ann? You want people to exercise their First Amendment right. You want them to get out, support their candidates and their issues. But you have to respect the privacy and the sanctity of the voting process itself and the privacy of the voting process. And so there are rules in place as far as how close you can get to folks when they're waiting in line and things like that. And again, sometimes, you know, depending on the passions that are aroused by that particular election, sometimes we see that becomes an issue. Sometimes we don't.
Now, last year, I don't think it'll be an issue this year, but last year there were really long lines around the Board of Elections waiting to early vote. Is that wherever anybody is in line? Are they're protected on that in that way?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how far away from the building or anything.
Yeah. They're not supposed to. People are not supposed to be within 10 feet of the voters as they're waiting in line. Now, you can shout pretty loudly from a distance of 10 feet and you can wave a sign pretty boldly from a distance of 10 feet. But they're not supposed to. The fact is the people that are out campaigning should not be physically interacting with voters as they're waiting to vote.
We're going to be doing a show tomorrow about kind of the nationalization of issues at the hyper-local level, particularly school boards elections. And I'm wondering if you're expecting to see maybe an uptick or maybe a burst from that kind of action.
I think so. And I think that's going to factor into this year's elections for sure. I haven't seen official predictions from the Secretary of State's office, but just generally speaking as a rule, and you're exactly right, the thing that really drives turnout is the interest level in that election. And given the fact that we have a lot more people running for school boards, there's a lot of attention focused on school boards, I would expect that that would be the case.
Then, like, twice as many people running.
I wasn't aware of that fact,
just
but
about
that sounds
twice as many,
that,
yeah.
That sounds right. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
What do you plan? Like, so what are you looking for this year to plan for next year? I mean, what's afoot in the Ohio General Assembly right now that people should be aware of when it comes to voting laws and voting processes?
Well, it won't be any surprise to know that both Republicans and Democrats in our state legislature have put forward different bills that they would like to see passed to address issues that came up in 2020. There's one in particular that I think has been kind of the focus. It's House Bill 294, and that's kind of a it deals with a lot of different topics. It deals with absentee voting. It deals with, ballot printing. I mean, it's everything from hyper technical policy things to very far ranging and important kind of big picture topics. And drop boxes and all of that stuff that you heard about and we talked about on your show last year. They're all addressed in that legislation.
The drop box remains a really big issue and something a lot of people can relate to. They conceptualize that very easily. Where does the Association of Boards of Elections or Association of Election Officials stand on that issue?
We love drop boxes. They were extremely important to the 2020 election, and we think they should continue unequivocally. So, you know, how many there should be?
One per county?
We would like to see at least one. We would like to see authority to offer one at a Board of Elections maintained, if not expanded. Certainly places like Cuyahoga County and Franklin County and Hamlin County, you could see where there would be a need for more. Smaller counties, they may just need one. And so we think that the Board of Elections at the local level is probably best positioned to make those decisions for their voters. They interact with their voters. So we're not necessarily in favor of a one-size-fits-all kind of solution, but we certainly want at least one.
What did you learn from last year about what kind of changes ordinary people are interested in?
Well, it was obviously you had 60% of the people voting early, which was completely unprecedented and certainly in response to the pandemic. But we expect that trend to continue. And so I think the big lesson is we need to make accommodations for how people want to vote. We need to meet the voter where they are. So anything that we can put forward from a policy perspective that encourages that or certainly responds to that, I think, is important for legislators to consider.
Do you foresee online? I mean, is online voting something they talk about?
Online voting is definitely something that's out there. I was part of a demonstration. There's a nonprofit group that's funded through a large philanthropist that is really investing in the technology and trying to find homes for pilot projects and things like that. Given the conversation around security and cybersecurity, I think probably we're at the beginning stages of that conversation, not toward the end of it, but there are folks out there definitely talking about it. But there are some other things that we can do that are super simple. You mentioned the whole how you have to request an absentee ballot.
Yeah.
You just have to do that by paper. It's crazy. You have to stick your paper request in the mail to the Board of Elections, and we'll send you a ballot.
You go online, you request the request.
Correct.
For the I probably misspoke there earlier.
No, that's right.
You go online, you request the request for the absentee ballot.
Correct. Yeah, and then we'll mail it to you. You can register to vote online in Ohio. It's been super successful. A lot of people avail themselves to that. There's no reason you should not be able to go online and actually download or request your absentee ballot through an online portal as well. We can do that safely and securely. We've proven that through the voter registration process.
So if you don't get it, ballot postmarked the day before, can you just go drop it off at a drop box?
You can drop it off at the drop box, or you can walk it into the Board of Elections. You cannot take it to your local polling location, though.
Okay.
They cannot accept absentee ballots at your polling location.
Talk about a little bit, explain again to people what provisional voting is and what their expectations should be about that process.
Provisional voting is a fail-safe mechanism. You should never, ever, ever show up at your polling location or at the Board of Elections and be told that you cannot vote for one reason or another. Provisional voting simply means that your registration may not be up to speed. You may have moved and not updated us, so we can't locate you within our poll book. So what we'll do is we'll offer you a provisional ballot. Some people refer to that as a second-class ballot. It is absolutely not. Some people say that we only count provisional ballots if it's close. That is absolutely false. Every provisional ballot that meets the requirements of the law, that demonstrates that you're a registered voter, that we can kind of do that little additional fact checking and figure out where you live, those ballots get counted. And we also use that provisional ballot to update your registration so you don't have to separately come back to us later and say, oh, by the way, I moved from Westerville to Dublin and I want to vote in Dublin now. We'll actually use your provisional ballot to do that for you.
If you're a registered voter and you move, you're okay. You can vote provisionally.
You can vote provisionally, yes, for
okay.
Sure. Well, everyone can vote provisionally. Whether or not it counts is going to depend on a couple of different factors.
But it will count.
Correct. Yeah. If you're a registered voter in the state and we can identify you, we will count certain races for you at that point.
The registration deadline's passed.
The registration deadline's passed. That's 30 days before the election, every election.
Do you see that changing?
That's in the Constitution, so that's
okay.
A little trickier thing to do. It would actually take the people rising up and wanting to change the Ohio Constitution to change that. And there are proposals out there. There was a ballot initiative in Michigan, actually, to do that, to create what's called basically same-day registration.
Uh-huh.
And there are certainly discussions around that in the state of Ohio.
I mean, I would imagine the 30-day thing back when the Constitution was written was a technological issue. They needed that much time to process things.
Sure. Yeah, same-day registration is definitely a voter-friendly type of initiative, but there are some back-end things that you need to consider. For example, if I can show up where I live in Westerville and vote normally and then walk over to Dublin and say, hey, I'm a new person, I'm not registered, mm-hmm. and I get to vote and the vote counts, well, then you obviously have double voting. So it's not, you know, it's an idea with merit that needs a lot of thought about how you're going to address some of those issues so you don't have people voting twice or taking advantage of the system.
But that's still a very, very rare event. Even then, right?
From what I can tell, there are systems in place in the dozen or so states that allow that to make sure that that does not happen. And I'm not super familiar with how that all works, but I understand that they've figured out ways to address it.
You know, it hasn't been as big of an issue in Ohio, but the question and the conspiracy theories that it was a stolen election in 2020 still is circulating. Very high up the former food chain. What about that issue? What do you tell people about that when they ask you about the security of the vote in Ohio?
Well, number one, the first question we ask is, have you been a poll worker? If we get a call, have you actually come in and seen how we do things and how we secure your ballot and all the checks and balances that are in place? So that's question number one that we always ask. And if not, we'll spend however long it takes with that voter to make sure they're educated about what we do, which includes, you know, having it starts with a bipartisan board of elections.
Mm-hmm.
It continues through extraordinarily detailed logic and accuracy testing of every piece of voting equipment. It continues with double checks and balances on your absentee voting and requiring multiple forms of identification multiple times. And it finishes with a very strong post-election audit, which showed a 99.98% accuracy rate in 2020. So we'll take the time when we'll educate folks and we'll encourage them to talk to us and get to know a little bit more about how we do things in Ohio and why we're very proud and confident that you can be secure and knowing your ballot counts.
Well, Aaron Ackerman, thanks so much for your time. I always appreciate it.
Thanks, Ann. I really appreciate it as well.
Aaron Ackerman is the executive director of the Ohio Association of Election Officials. We will continue coming up. We're going to be talking about the 15th congressional district race, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. There are two special congressional elections in Ohio this year. The 11th District, held for 13 years by Democrat Marsha Fudge, who was appointed the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Biden administration. And the 15th District, held for 10 years by Republican Steve Stivers, who left to take the helm of the Ohio Chamber of Commerce. Now, the 15th District includes parts of urban and suburban Columbus and extends south into rural Appalachia, Ohio. Haley B. Miller is a political reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. She's been covering the 15th district race. Haley, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So covering this race involves a lot of travel. It's a big lumbering district that goes, you know, in a lot of different directions.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see the makeup of the district. You know, I've been in campaign events in Upper Arlington. I went to a couple in Pickerington. And, it really is a wide swath of voters that these candidates are trying to appeal to right now.
So like down south, where the district extends into southern Ohio, what's the district like down there?
It's a lot more rural. You get a lot more of the conservative voters down there who are a lot of people who were, you know, proponents of former President Trump. You know, again, very different than what you might get in Upper Arlington or Hilliard. So, a lot of those kind of more rural conservative voters.
On the Republican side, we have a former coal lobbyist, Mike Keary. He's been endorsed, at least during the primary, by Donald Trump, which helped him emerge from a crowded Republican primary. What's his story?
Keary was a longtime lobbyist for, first they were known as Murray Energy, and now it's American Consolidated Natural Resources. So he has a long history in the coal industry. He's also a longtime friend of Corey Lewandowski, who was a former Trump aide and kind of helped, get Keary on Trump's radar and kind of helped facilitate that endorsement. So Kerry's never held public office before. You know, he's been in the state house, familiar with the players, and is sort of casting himself as a political outsider because he never has held public office before. A similar line that we heard from Trump back in 2016.
But he knows all the players. He's in the state house all the time.
Right. And so he says, you know, because the argument is, well, how can a lobbyist really be an outsider? But Kerry's argument is, you know, I've been working against these politicians for a long time. I know how they work. I know how to get things done. So that's how he's presenting himself.
The Democratic candidate is State Representative Allison Russo. Tell us about her.
She has been in the legislature since 2018, and that year she actually flipped her district from red to blue. She also comes from a public health background, and so she's been, presenting herself as someone who can work across the aisle. She has some bipartisan legislative accomplishments, particularly in the public health sector. So she is, really trying to present herself as a team player, which her opponent disagrees with, but that's sort of her story.
Because he would know her because he's at the state house as a lobbyist.
Right. And he's also been working pretty hard to try to kind of put her in the same corner as, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, saying that, if Russo's elected, she's, going to pass this massive spending bill and cause inflation to go up. All arguments that Republicans are going to certainly be using against Democrats in the midterms next year.
Okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about that 15th congressional district race. It's a special election. Election day is Tuesday. It's just a week away. I'm talking with Haley B. Miller. She is a political reporter for USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and she's been covering the race. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. All right, so what is Allison Russo saying about her opponent? What is she saying about Mike Keary?
One of the hallmarks of her campaign has been pointing out Keary's ties to the House Bill 6 scandal. Murray Energy, which Keary's worked for a long time, they were dubbed Company B in the criminal complaint against Larry Householder, detailing the alleged bribery scheme.
The biggest corruption scandal in Ohio history, like to say.
Yeah.
Rolls off the tongue.
And Murray Energy back in the day gave, I think it was around $100,000 to the group that was backing Householder candidates. Robert Murray, who passed somewhat recently, was a very prominent donor to Republican politicians.
Longtime donor, yeah.
Yeah, he was a Trump donor as well. When I've talked to Keary about this, he said, this was just, one of many things that, Murray would donate to. Sometimes Robert Murray would consult with him about, who they were donating to, but not all the time. And, Keary has said that the company ultimately remained neutral on House Bill 6. He was registered as a lobbyist, but they never testified or anything. All that said, this has been a big sticking point for Russo, pointing out his ties to this, alleging that he has, kind of covered up his relationships with those people. And another thing, too, I think being supported by Trump and being part of the coal industry, I think, in a lot of ways. You know, he's kind of a the typical caricature of a Republican that, you know, a lot of Democrats don't really want to see in office right now. And so she's certainly pointing that out to people as well.
And how's that playing down in, you know, coal country?
You know, I think in the more rural parts of this district, I mean, Kerry is going to come through, you know, especially in these areas where Trump was popular. You know, I think they see Kerry as someone who who's going to fight for their jobs, who wants to, you know, take on Democratic leadership that, you know, a lot of people are blaming for, you know, inflation right now. You know, so I think in that sense, for that, you know, part of the district, he's really going to resonate with those voters.
Trump endorsed Kerry in the primary, as I said earlier. Did that make a big difference, do you think?
I think so. You know, it was interesting. With as crowded as that field was, I wasn't sure going into the primary, you know, who would win by what margin. But Kerry really came away with a significant portion of the vote for being that crowded of a field. And I do think Trump's endorsement played into that and the connections he was able to leverage through that. You know, he's also been, you know, very, both in the primary and the general election cycle, he's, you know, a very active campaigner. He's definitely out and about all over the district. And so I think that is an asset to him as well.
Steve Stivers endorsed State Rep Jeff Luray, or I think that's how you pronounce his name, in the Republican primary to replace him. Has he come out in support of Kerry since?
He has. You know, I think at the end of the day, Stivers wants to see another Republican succeed him. He donated some money to Kerry's campaign in the latest spending period. So, yeah, he's definitely backing Kerry at this point.
15th district is gerrymandered to favor a Republican, of course, by a full 9 percentage points in this case, according to the Cook Partisan Voting Index. And I'm wondering, you know, Trump won that district by 15 percentage points in 2020. You know, I'm wondering if Alison Russo has a shot and what the thoughts are about that.
Probably not. I mean, this is a very, you know, like, as you said, it's a gerrymandered district. And while it does include some parts of Columbus and some parts of suburban Columbus that might be a little bit more blue, it's also very red, very rural.
It depends on turnout, too, right?
Right. Yeah. And turnout is not going to be anything to write home about because it is a special election in an off year. You know, that said, you know, Kerry has told me that, you know, because it is a special election, you know, they're not taking anything for granted because they do know turnout's going to be low. So they're, you know, campaigning as if the district is competitive. He's got some help from, you know, sort of the national players and the GOP. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy was in the district recently. But, you know, all that said, oh, and another thing to note, one thing that did surprise me was that Russo actually slightly outraised him.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
So, I mean, that's interesting, too. And certainly
what does it tell you?
You know, it tells me that she does have a lot of support. And, you know, it is possible that this could end up being closer than we think it'll be, especially because, you know, again, a special election, all bets are off. But I still think at the end of the day, Kerry's probably going to go through, pull through, just because, you know, the way this district is drawn is
right.
Not.
How does the fact that it's a special election impact the race? It's a special, it's not just an off year, it's also a special election. Do you think people are really plugged into it at all?
I don't get the sense that people are excessively tuned in. I mean, they're going to start, you know, they've been seeing the television ads. But even the candidates have told me, you know, when they go door knocking, they have to
explain
like what they're doing and the fact that there is an election. And, you know, turnout was low in the August primary, too. So it really just does it's very different than a normal year.
Is this for a full term? How does that work? They're just filling out the term of Stivers' term? Or
yeah, so whoever wins actually has to pick back up and run for re-election for 2022. And, you know, whoever loses next week will probably end up running again. And so, yeah, it's a tight window, pretty much campaigning for 2 years straight.
How these special elections are, and also, you know, an opportunity to consider what's coming up next year and what the midterms might look like. What are you seeing as far as winning issues and strategies that are being employed by the candidates at this point?
Republicans see 2022 as sort of their ticket to get back control of the House and Senate. And historically, that's not out of the realm of possibility. We know midterm elections are always worse for the party in the White House. And so in terms of issues being discussed right now on the GOP side, Afghanistan is a big one. A lot of people are frustrated about how we withdrew from the country and are using that as a sticking point. Again, I mentioned inflation. People are blaming that on the Biden administration, rightly or wrongly. You know, on the Democratic side, they're saying, well, look, we passed this major stimulus package for you at the beginning of the year. We got you child tax credit. We helped out working families. You know, this is why, you know, you should keep us in power next year. But they face some challenges right now because, as we know, the bipartisan infrastructure deal negotiated in part by Senator Rob Portman has mm-hmm. yet to get to Biden's desk. Mm-hmm. And the reconciliation bill for social services and climate change and other Democratic priorities is stalling because of Democratic infighting. So they, in addition to what they're going to be getting from Republicans, they have a lot going on with their own party as well.
Jennifer in New Albany, you're on the air. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I just have a comment and about bipartisan and who's paying attention and the polls, how they reflect that there's more Republicans and so they're thinking it's going to go towards Kerry. But I think that what we aren't polling is that there's a lot of Republicans out there that really value the same values that Russo, is that her name?
Yes, Allison Russo, values. Yeah.
She's got kids. She teaches them, you know, to tell the truth. It matters. Who she's running against obviously doesn't think it matters. And the other guy, what's his name with the helmet, who, you know, thinks that as a Republican, he can speak for me, that I hate America and I hate Christians. He can't speak for me. Mm. That's not right. And he's bad mojo. So I'm just saying, I'm a Republican, not buying that stuff, and I think a lot of people feel like I do.
Thanks,
thank
Jennifer.
You.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
All right, so the again, that's another suburban area that is in play in the 15th?
Right, and I think an interesting thing about the suburbs is, you know, there are, across the country, you know, suburban women in particular have, you know, crossed, because of sort of the Trump era, have crossed the threshold. You know, they were Republicans, they were supporting Republicans, but they didn't, started not liking what was coming out of their party. So they started backing Democrats. And I think, you know, that is an area where maybe Russo could appeal, you know, as Jennifer mentioned, you know, as a mom, as someone, you know, who has, you know, worked across the aisle. You know, I definitely think she's not painting herself as, you know, a super progressive Democrat. You know, she's trying to ride the middle a little bit more, I think.
Well, Haley B. Miller, thanks for coming in today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Haley B. Miller. She is a political reporter for USA Today Network, Ohio Bureau. We've been talking about the 15th Congressional District Special Election, which occurs next Tuesday on Election Day. So don't forget to vote. We are going to talk about Issue 7 on the Columbus ballot coming up. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Franklin County voters face one issue on the November 2nd ballot, Issue 7, described by its proponents as green energy initiative, but opposed by a host of environmental groups, including the Sierra Club of Ohio, Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther, and Columbus City Council President Shannon Hardin. Mike Curtin is a former editor and associate publisher of the Columbus Dispatch. He also served as president, CEO, and vice chairman of the Dispatch Printing Company. And from 2013 to 2016, he was a Democratic member of the Ohio House of Representatives. He's here to speak against Issue 7. Welcome back, Mike.
Thank you, Ann.
And Tom Bosco is a reporter at WSYX-TV. He's been covering Issue 7. We invited a representative of the group behind Issue 7 to join us. They did not respond. Issue 7 would direct $87 million from the city's general fund and give a small committee of unelected people control of that money. For what exactly is the ultimate mystery, I guess? Tom Bosco, Pro Energy Ohio is the group behind Issue 7, at least on paper it is. In preparation for the show, we tried to get in contact with anyone over there. You've been trying to do the same thing. Are you having any luck?
Well, actually, today I had some luck because the man behind Pro Energy Ohio, John Clark, was due in court this morning.
Okay.
We will get to that in a moment. So yep. I finally did get a chance to speak with attorneys for Mr. Clark. They did not have, well, they had a handful to say, but they would not make Mr. Clark available for me to answer any questions. But Pro Energy Ohio is actually, yes, very difficult to find anything about. I could only find a Facebook page linked to them. It had a email link that really nobody answered. It had a phone number that I called this phone number. It was for a completely different business. They had no idea what Pro Energy Ohio was. They had no idea what Issue 7 was. And it also had a link to a website, and that website was just a kind of a placeholder, a dead website. So really, it when city officials call this mysterious, there certainly is some mystery to it.
But it's not the first time, right?
That's right. This isn't the first time they've attempted this. They tried this in 2017, and they also tried it in checks notes in 2019. And then they tried this last year in October. They got more than 10,000 signatures for their petition to get this on the ballot. In November of last year, City Attorney Zach Klein found it to be deficient and kicked it out. And then they fought it. The folks, the Pro Energy Ohio folks, fought this, and it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in April of this year ruled that council did have to approve this. It's a city issue, so it would be approved by city council.
I said Franklin County, and it's city. It's the city of Columbus, right?
Right. And the Ohio Supreme Court ruled that the city of Columbus did have to approve this and put it on the ballot, and that's where we are today with this.
Mike Curtin, why do they keep coming back? I mean, what do you know about this group?
Because $87 million is $87 million. And now they've circulated petitions, you may have read in last Saturday's Dispatch, for another round. I think they're assuming they're going to lose this time out. And the petition they are now circulating to get on the ballot at a future election would give them $107 million, not $87. So they're already adding $20 million to their ask. You know, under the rubric of green energy. But these folks have been kicking around since 2013-14. And as Tom said, you know, they had a couple of failed efforts to get on the statewide ballot for a proposed state constitutional amendment. I think we took care of that in 15. I was co-sponsor of an amendment that passed, fortunately, that makes it exceedingly difficult for anybody to use the initiative power at the state level to create an exclusive economic benefit. And that was in conjunction with the marijuana monopoly crowd.
Right.
You know, that we're circulating an effort and got it on the ballot that had it passed would have made only 10 parcels in the entire state of Ohio, parcels where it would have been legal to grow marijuana for commercial purposes. And we defeated that. We got the amendment that I co-sponsored. And now, quite frankly, we have to look at getting a similar effort done at the city level across Ohio, because we have 2,200-plus municipal corporations, cities and villages in the state. They almost all allow for the initiative process. And if we don't nip this in the bud at some point, it's just going to come back and come back and come back.
What do we know about why they keep picking on Columbus? Why do they keep targeting Columbus at this point?
Well, I don't know why they keep targeting Columbus, but they do have some specific things that they say they want to do with this money. $87 million, they want to divert it out of the city general fund. $57 million would go to a Columbus Clean Energy Partnership Fund. $10 million to an Energy Conservation and Efficiency Fund. $10 million for Clean Energy education and training, and $10 million for a minority business enterprise clean energy development fund. All those are really buzzy words, and I don't know if they think that by, you know, parading these buzzwords out that sound good, that they can generate some support for this. I did, as I said, speak to the attorneys today, mm-hmm. and I kind of pressed and said, what is this money going to go to? I mean, describe what this money to a fund is nice, but what is mm-hmm. this going to happen? What's going to happen with this money? They say they want to do subsidies for clean energy suppliers, and they want to subsidize ratepayers' electric bills and have them be able to choose from a list of green energy suppliers, some in Ohio, some in New York. And so they also want to fund minority businesses, it sound like, that are involved in clean energy. But it I mean, nebulous is kind of the buzzword here that keeps popping up.
That's right. They use all the buzzwords, but there's no specificity
right.
in it, other than Section 4 of the initiative would require the city auditor to turn over $87 million to an entity that would be named by a representative representing the six now, because one of them's dead, the six petitioners. So they get to choose what bank or what entity they want the city to ship this $87 million to, and that's 10% of the entire city's general fund budget. This is the biggest scam we've ever seen on the ballot in the city's history.
All right, so what do we know about the people behind it? You said one of them died, so we know one of them died. They're humans.
Well, to Tom's earlier point, yeah. they've not made themselves available.
And they don't have to.
They don't have to make themselves available. No, Tom and Bill Bush at the Dispatch and a lot of other reporters have tried to run these people down, and they are not making themselves available.
How you talked about stopping this at the city level, like you did at the state level, this ability to get it on the ballot in this way for these kinds of things. What would you do exactly? I mean, what do you mean? How would you stop it at the city level?
Would ask the General Assembly to pass a legislation to update the initiative process in the Ohio Revised Code. Of those 2,200-plus municipalities in the state, about 183 of them are charter cities. The rest are non-charter. So either the charters of those cities or state general law provides for the initiative process. Mm-hmm. And I would have the legislature amend that section, basically saying that the initiative process shall not be used to create an exclusive benefit or an exclusive deal for any person, business, entity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So it wouldn't make it harder for people to get initiatives on the ballot. It would make it harder for people with that kind of
The initiative process is time-tested. The initiative has existed in the Ohio Constitution since 1912 and has existed in the city charter since 1914. It's there for a reason. It's good. It allows the people to bypass the legislature when the legislature ignores the public will. It was never intended to create exclusive economic benefits, and now it's being used this way across the country. David Broder wrote about this back in 1990, and it's been getting worse ever since. Where some sharp entrepreneurs have said, you know what, with enough money, we can circulate petitions, we can qualify things for the ballot, and we can create an exclusive for ourselves. That was happened with the casinos in 2009. Mm-hmm. In 2015, the Marijuana Monopoly Boys tried it with marijuana. If we don't find a way to create a wall against this sort of thing, we're going to be fighting it year in and year out. Again, last Saturday's paper said these guys are already circulating for the next time around.
Right.
You know, one thing that the folks who are backing this point out is that in that levy language, or not levy language, but in that language on Issue 7, there is a mechanism for a quarterly transparency and accountability report done by the auditor. So they claim that this is not being done in the dark. But Shannon Harden, president of City Council, told me last week, these people are, the six people on this committee, are unelected and unaccountable. And that's his worry in all of this.
Tell me, I want to get back to John Clark real quick here and tell us, why is he in court today?
Well, I will tell you what I was told by former prosecutor for Franklin County, Ron O'Brien. I interviewed him last week for this. So apparently there were some red flags raised about the contributors for this political contributors.
Because you do have to report political contributions,
right? And these political contributors contributed between $3,000 and $10,000 or $13,000, and I don't know exactly what the red flags were that were raised, but it led investigators to dig into this a little bit. And they went and interviewed these people who are the contributors listed. And Ron O'Brien tells me that these contributors said, "We didn't contribute this money. We don't have that kind of money to give." And so that led to these charges against John Clark, and he faces two counts of election falsification and two counts of tampering with evidence. Now, he was supposed to be in court this morning. His attorneys told me they were going to ask for a continuance on that hearing. I was at the courthouse this morning, chatted with his attorneys, didn't see Mr. Clark, and I don't know if he
would
was going to make
him
it
Would you know him if you saw him?
I would not know okay. him if, he saw, if I saw him, as a matter of fact. And actually, I talked to Shannon Harden, as I said, city council president last week, and that was his whole, "Yeah, I've never met this guy. He's never addressed city council. I don't know. Do you know him?" That's what he asked.
And speaking of economic benefits, this language, as the Dispatch has pointed out, and I think other reporters have pointed out, allows these people to pay themselves administrative fees and puts no cap on what they can pay themselves. So conceivably, I mean, use your imagination. Mm-hmm. If they get this $87 million transferred to themselves, what they might pay themselves in the way of salaries, bonuses, God knows what.
Do they have to explain in the language what they're going to use the – I mean, we know it goes to these funds, but why $87 million?
$57 million ostensibly is set aside for electric rate subsidies for electricity customers in the city of Columbus. But there's no specificity as to how these subsidies would be awarded, who would be eligible. It seemingly leaves it open to the petitioners to decide for themselves who would qualify and who would get how much.
Has there been any news out of the clean energy industry about what they think about this?
Not that I have seen. I haven't heard much. How about you, Mike?
Every environmental group is on record in opposition to this. So all the green groups that we're familiar with, the Sierra Club, the Nature Conservancy, the Ohio Environmental Council, they're all lined up in opposition to this scam.
Right. But the actual industry itself, you know, the solar, the wind, that kind of a thing, we don't know.
I've not heard from
where
them.
They're at on this.
What I also find interesting is that you really don't hear from pro-issue 7 people at all. On this.
Yeah.
I mean, there's really not been much of a campaign, not been much of an effort. You don't see any commercials or see any mailings or the like on that.
And then again, why Columbus, Mike? Do you have any?
Columbus is where the money is.
Just
in
because
my view.
I was going to say, because they have the bottom line.
It's the biggest city. It's got the biggest general fund budget. If they can do this in Columbus, they ostensibly could do it elsewhere. But my fear, as I said, is we've got cities all across the state and all across the country where the initiative is embedded either in city charter or in the state statutes that govern these cities. And this is the sort of thing that, if successful someplace, is going to be replicated elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's important, one, to stop it, and then, two, to create a bar so the initiative process can't be misused like this in the future.
Do you have signals from the Ohio General Assembly that they're going to do something about it?
No, I do not. But I have been talking to folks at City Hall about mobilizing an effort using the Ohio Municipal League, perhaps other organizations that would be like-minded.
Yeah. And what are you going to be looking for? I mean, what are your expectations, Tom Bosco, that this could pass this time around? Now, they're already collecting signatures, so I have to figure they've already been doing their own homework on that score.
Well, that and the fact that they haven't been actively campaigning for this yet tells me that they—
Have they ever?
Not that I have seen at this point. But it's gotten so much bad publicity that you would think it might go down, but, to defeat. And that's why they obviously have tried to get this again for next November. But, we'll see what happens with this. I'm going to continue to try to keep digging and find some of these people who are ostensibly involved in this. And I just find it interesting that they won't put this guy out there for me to ask him some questions. And his criminal attorney says he doesn't want to taint the process and he doesn't want, that to be connected to that. But I said, "But don't you even want this guy to promote his own issue that he's behind?" And they declined.
Tom Bosco, reporter at WSYX-TV, thank you so much for your time today.
Excited to be here.
And Mike Curtin, thanks so much for your time, former editor and associate publisher of the Columbus Dispatch and a member of the Ohio House of Representatives as well. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.